Regulation precedes communication, always.
Yeah.
No exceptions. I want you to stop what you're doing and just sit with that phrase for a second. Regulation precedes communication.
Yeah, I mean, that's a line in the sand, isn't it? It sounds so simple, but it just completely upends the table on how we usually think about, you know, neurodivergence.
It really does, because I want you, our listener, to imagine a world where your ability to speak or to learn something new or even just to look someone in the eye is completely secondary to just feeling safe inside your own skin.
Mm-hmm.
Imagine your nervous system is basically a fire alarm that is stuck in the on position, just screaming at you.
Right.
And while that alarm is blaring, everyone around you is trying to teach you algebra or table manners or how to say please.
It just changes the entire conversation. You know, if we really accept that premise that a regulated body is the absolute non-negotiable prerequisite for a learning brain, then almost everything we traditionally do for severe autism might need to be, thrown out and rebuilt from scratch.
And that is exactly what we are unpacking today. We've got this fascinating document here called Core Principles for Severe Autism Repatterning, dated January 2026.
Right.
And I know the title sounds a bit academic, but this is not your standard medical textbook stuff. It's this incredibly unique, almost paradoxical framework that merges two very different worlds. On one side, you have hardcore, cutting-edge neuroplasticity research, specifically the work of Paul Bakarita.
A legend in the field. Total legend.
Right. And then on the other side, you've got ancient Buddhist psychology, specifically this concept of skillful means.
Which sounds like a contradiction, doesn't it? Science and, you know, spirituality meeting in the middle to solve a very modern crisis.
Exactly.
But as we went through this source material, the overlap is just undeniable.
Absolutely. So the mission of this deep dive is to understand why that traditional fix-the-behavior approach often backfires so spectacularly in these severe cases. And more importantly, we're going to walk through a specific step-by-step protocol that's all about building trust without using force.
And I think we need to be very specific about who we're talking about here. The source isn't focused on, say, level one autism or someone who's just quirky but holding down a job.
Yeah.
We are focusing on what's called severe autism or non-speaking autism. We're looking at individuals where the nervous system is operating at what the text calls a high gain.
High gain. I highlighted that term like three times in my notes. It feels like the Rosetta Stone for this whole document. But let's break that down. What does it actually mean physically to have a high gain brain?
Okay, well, think of it like audio equipment, like a microphone amplifier. If you turn the gain knob all the way up, what happens?
You catch everything.
You catch too much.
Yeah.
Even a whisper sounds like a scream. The background hum of the refrigerator becomes a roar.
Oh, wow.
And if someone actually speaks at a normal volume, you get feedback. Painful screeching feedback.
So it's not a processing error. It's a volume issue.
That's it. Exactly.
Yeah.
The source argues that severe autism isn't necessarily a deficit in the way we usually think of it. You know, like something is missing or broken.
Yeah.
It's an extreme form of sensory processing where everything just comes in too loud. There's almost no automatic filtering.
That's actually terrifying to imagine. You or I, we can tune out the tag on our shirt, the traffic outside, the hum of the computer. We don't even notice it. Our brains just delete it.
But for this profile, those signals are coming in at max volume all the time. It's a constant bombardment. And this is the crucial reframe. Because that input is so overwhelming, the brain has to find a way to stabilize itself.
No.
The source calls it sensory predictive stabilization. The brain is just desperately trying to predict and control the environment to keep from crashing.
Which brings us right to rigidity. This is the friction point for every single caregiver. You know, you just want to go to the store, but if you don't take the exact same route or if the blue cup isn't available, everything just falls apart.
It feels like stubbornness. It feels behavioral. Mm. But this framework argues it is absolutely not stubbornness. It is life-saving regulation. The source calls it an anchor map or a base camp.
An anchor map.
Yeah. Because the world is so chaotic and loud to their nervous system, the brain locks onto the narrowest possible map that preserves coherence.
So that rocking motion or that specific DVD menu screen playing on a loop, that's not them checking out. That's their life raft.
Precisely. It's the only thing that is predictable.
Yeah.
And if you take away the life raft in the middle of a storm, you don't get someone who learns to swim.
You get someone who drowns.
You get someone who drowns. The source uses incredibly strong language here. It says, disrupting these routines without a backup plan causes autonomic collapse. It triggers panic, aggression, or a total shutdown.
That's a heavy realization. If you view the behavior as bad, you try to stop it. But if you view it as safety, then stopping it is actually, it's cruel.
It's counterproductive to their biology. And that leads us directly into the critique of traditional behavioral models. The source is pretty critical of approaches that prioritize outward compliance, things like ABA-derived models, when they're applied to these specific high-gain cases.
Yeah, let's get into the weeds on that. The document says that forcing compliance or removing self-stimulation increases threat salience. That sounds technical, but the implication is huge.
Threat salience just means how much the brain is scanning for danger.
Okay.
So if a child is rocking to regulate their overwhelming sensory input, and you physically stop them, or you reward them for quiet hands, you haven't removed the sensory overwhelm. You've just removed their only coping mechanism.
You've taken their shield away while the arrows are still flying.
That is the perfect image. The brain doesn't learn, oh, I should sit still. It learns, I am not safe, and I have no way to protect myself.
Wow.
The document quotes a Buddhist principle here that really struck me, is suffering arises when contact overwhelms capacity.
Meaning, if the sensory input, the contact, is higher than the person's ability to process it, they suffer. And forcing them to act normal under those conditions just, it deepens the suffering.
It hardens the brain's defensive maps. They retreat further into that rigidity because the world has just proven itself to be hostile.
There's another fascinating point here about attachment. We usually think of attachment as emotional, right? Loving your mom because she's mom. But this text says for severe autism, attachment is sensory, not symbolic. This one blew my mind a little bit.
It's a huge aha moment, isn't it?
It is.
In a neurotypical relationship, attachment is based on the idea of the person, their identity. But in a high-gain nervous system, the attachment locks on to specific sensory details. A voice frequency. A gait pattern, the rhythm of how someone walks, a specific touch pressure.
So the child isn't necessarily attached to mom as a concept, but to the specific 60-beat-per-minute rhythm of mom's heartbeat, or the specific pitch of her humming.
Right. And this explains a tragedy that happens in so many families. A substitute caregiver comes in, maybe a respite worker. They're incredibly kind, they do everything right, they follow all the instructions.
And they're rejected. Violently.
And the parents feel embarrassed. The worker feels like they failed.
But the child isn't rejecting the person's kindness.
No. They're rejecting a sensory mismatch. The map doesn't match the anchor. To the child's brain, it's like the floor suddenly turned into lava. It's not an emotional rejection. It's sensory panic.
That just reframes the difficult child narrative completely.
Right.
So, okay. If we accept that we can't just force behavior change and we can't just swap people in and out, what do we do?
Right.
And this is where the science of skillful means comes in. Introduce us to Paul Bacchiarita. Why is he the key here?
Paul Bacchiarita was a giant in the field of neuroplasticity. I mean, he's famous for saying, we see with our brains, not with our eyes.
Right.
He developed technology that allowed blind people to see using tactile stimulation on their tongues.
Which sounds like science fiction.
It does. But it worked. And his core finding, the one this protocol uses, is about how the brain actually remaps itself.
And the key ingredients are not force or willpower.
No. The key ingredients are safety, consistency, redundancy, feedback, and time. Bacchiarita proved that for the brain to build a new map, to learn a new way of being, it has to feel safe enough to experiment. If the brain is in threat mode, plasticity just shuts down. You can't learn when you're fighting for your survival.
And the source connects this to monastic life, which I thought was such a cool, unexpected parallel.
It is, but if you look at it neurologically, it makes perfect sense. Think about a monastery. Extreme routine, repetition, silence, predictability.
Mm-hmm.
We often think of those as religious practices, but from a neurological perspective, they are aggressive nervous system regulation. They lower the game. And the source argues we need to apply that same skillful means to autism, create an environment of extreme safety and predictability to lower that game.
Okay, so we have the theory. Regulation first. Don't take away the anger. Now let's get into the how-to. The document outlines a very specific protocol. It starts with phase one, baseline stabilization.
Right, and the first step is totally passive on the caregiver's part. And this is really hard for people who want to fix things.
Yeah.
You have to stop trying to change them and start playing detective. You need to identify the primary regulatory channel.
And the text is strict here. You do not choose this, you discover it.
That's it. When the individual is stressed, what do they naturally go to? Is it vestibular? Do they rock or spin? Is it auditory? Do they hum a specific tone? Is it proprioceptive? Do they need deep pressure?
Once you find it, that becomes the anchor map. And the rule is, this map is sacred.
Sacred, non-negotiable. You do not fade it out. You do not restrict it. If they need to rock in the blue chair to feel safe, they get the blue chair. This creates the base camp. You are proving to their nervous system that you are not a threat. You're aligning with their need for safety.
Okay, but I can hear the parents listening right now saying, great, but I can't leave them in the blue chair for the rest of their life. The goal is flexibility. So how do we move from the anchor to something else? This brings us to phase two. Parallel mapping.
And this is the genius of the Bacharita approach.
Right.
You don't remove the chair. You add a parallel input. The rule is never remove a stabilizing map without first creating a parallel one.
Okay, walk us through this. How does this look in a real living room?
Let's stick with the blue chair example. Say the anchor is rocking in that specific chair at a specific rhythm. Phase two would be introducing a second rocking chair, maybe a different color or texture, but ensuring the rhythm, the vestibular input, is exactly the same.
If you
place it nearby, you might model using it. You don't force them into it. You just create redundancy.
So the brain starts to see that the sensation of safety, the rocking, can't exist in more than one place.
Exactly. Or let's say the anchor is a specific song. They only calm down to Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. You play that same song, same tempo, but maybe on a different instrument. A piano instead of a violin. You're teaching the brain equivalence. You're showing the nervous system that safety isn't just this one specific MP3 file, but a pattern that can exist in slightly different forms.
It's like widening the bridge before you ask them to cross it.
That's a perfect analogy. And you do this slowly. The source emphasizes you run both channels together. You don't take away the old one. You just offer the new one alongside it. It's all about redundancy.
Right.
If you have two maps, the brain relaxes. If you swap one for the other, the brain panics.
And then once they accept that parallel channel, maybe they actually sit in the new chair on their own. We move to phase three, microvariability. This is where we actually start to stretch the brain's tolerance.
But we stretch it by millimeters, not miles. The source suggests a 5 to 10% rule. You change one parameter, and only one, by about 5 to 10%.
Give me an example of a 5% change. That seems so small.
It is small.
Mm-hmm.
If it's music, maybe you turn the volume down by just one notch. If it's deep pressure, you hold the squeeze for 1 second longer than usual. If it's a rocking chair, maybe you move it 6 inches to the left.
Did that actually do anything? It seems so tiny.
It has to be tiny. You are training prediction error tolerance. Remember, the autistic brain in this state hates prediction errors.
Mm-hmm.
That's why surprises cause meltdowns.
Okay.
By introducing a tiny safe error, a 5% change, the brain goes, wait, that's different. Bye.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm still safe. Okay.
And you just repeat that over and over.
Yes. And here is the catch. If distress spikes, you revert immediately. You go back to the anchor. You prove again and again that safety is always available. Over time, those 5% changes add up. 5% becomes 10, becomes 50. And suddenly the person can handle a different chair, a different room, a different volume. That is neuroplasticity in action.
I love that. It's so methodical, it's respectful, and it really takes the pressure off the caregiver to create these big breakthroughs every day.
Yeah.
It's just about the next 5%.
It's the compounding interest of safety.
Now, I know the question listeners are asking. We talked about rocking and humming and chairs. What about talking? What about I love you? What about connection? Because for so many parents, that silence is the most painful part.
And the source addresses this in a section called Emergent Communication. And the headline is, communication is a byproduct.
The byproduct, not the goal. That's a hard pill to swallow for a lot of people.
It is, but think about the biology. If you are terrified, if your alarm system is blaring, are you looking to chat? Are you looking to socialize?
No, you're looking for an exit.
Exactly. Communication, social engagement, eye contact, shared attention. These are things that humans naturally do only when they feel safe.
So the protocol says, stop trying to train eye contact. Stop trying to force words.
It says, trying to force communication before regulation is like trying to plant a garden in the middle of a hurricane. It won't work. Instead, you watch for neuroplastic markers. When sensory trust is established, when that gain knob gets turned down, you will see spontaneous changes.
Like what?
The child might look at you for a split second longer. They might start vocalizing playfully. They might bring you an object.
And the document distinguishes these from trained behaviors.
That's the critical distinction. Mm-hmm. If you train a child to look you in the eye by giving them a candy every time they do it, that's a performance. It doesn't mean they're connecting with you. It means they're performing a trick to get a reward.
Right.
In fact, for a high-gain person, looking at eyes might be incredibly overstimulating. So you're basically paying them to endure pain.
Oof.
When you put it that way. But if a child looks you in the eye spontaneously, because they feel safe and curious, that is actual connection. That is the brain opening up. That is emergent behavior. It wasn't taught. It grew out of safety.
This really shifts how we define success then. The source has a whole list of what to measure and what not to measure.
Right. We need to stop measuring compliance. Stop measuring how normal they look. Stop counting how many words they say on command.
Instead, we measure recovery time.
Yes. If a meltdown happens, does it last an hour or 10 minutes? That is a huge metric of success. We measure sensory tolerance range. Can they handle three different types of shirts now instead of just one? We measure willingness to explore.
The ultimate goal isn't to make them act normal. The goal is what the source calls a regulation portfolio.
I love that term. A portfolio.
Yeah.
If you only have one stock in your portfolio and it crashes, you're bankrupt.
Sure.
If a child only has one way to regulate rocking in the blue chair and the chair breaks, they are in crisis. The goal is to give them a portfolio of 10, 20 ways to regulate. Rocking, humming, squeezing, walking, music. If they have options, they have freedom.
Freedom, autistic style. That's a quote from the text.
And that's what this is really about. It's not about making them like us. It's about giving them the tools to be comfortable being themselves.
So let's wrap this up. We've gone from the high-gain brain to the anchor map, through the failure of forced compliance, and into this gentle, repetitive, redundant protocol of expanding safety. It feels like a massive shift in perspective.
It's a journey from viewing the rigidity as the problem to viewing it as the solution that just needs to be expanded. It's a shift from correcting a broken child to aligning with a sensitive nervous system.
The ethical takeaway here is huge. The document says this framework eliminates coercion.
And it explains why patience is not passive. I think caregivers often feel like if they aren't doing something, correcting, prompting, teaching, they're giving up. This source argues that patience, observing and holding that space of safety, is active neuroplastic work. You are literally building the substrate for their brain to heal and learn.
That's so empowering. It's not just waiting. It's building the foundation.
Absolutely.
I want to leave you with a final thought from the text, something they call functional awakening. It challenges us to rethink the very definition of a liberated life. If we stop demanding verbal fluency and independence as the only markers of a good life, and instead we focus on reducing distress and expanding trust, how much of what we call disability is actually just a nervous system screaming for safety?
That is the question. If we can lower the volume of the world for them, who knows what they might have to say.
Exactly. Thank you for listening to this deep dive. As always, stay curious, stay open, and we'll see you next time.